This is AMDA On The Go, your gateway to expert discussions, journal article reviews, and innovation in post-acute and long-term care. AMDA On The Go is a presentation of the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine. Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post-Acute Care. This podcast is eligible for ABPLM pre-approved certified medical director credits. Details will be provided at the end of this podcast. And now here's our host for AMDA On The Go, Dr. Wayne Saltzman.
Welcome to AMDA On The Go. This podcast will focus on caregiving and the impact of gerontology on our healthcare continuum. Many years ago, I co-led an Alzheimer's support group in my own town. At one session, there was a new face, a slight, pale, and spiritually and physically fatigued appearing older gentleman who volunteered his story and the care he was providing his wife at home. His dedication to his oath of 62 years was overwhelming, and the depth of his commitment to his wife left all in the group speechless. In a private moment afterwards, I asked him, "How much more can you take?" He responded simply, "She's my wife." But I think he knew that I was thinking that the woman he was caring for now truly hadn't been the woman he had married for many years. The caregiver, probably the most important and the least recognized and respected role in healthcare, a role that requires such attention that the Centers for Disease Control, CDC, has a dedicated section on its site called Caregiving, with an introduction proclaiming caregiving to be a public health priority because the health of the caregiver is at such risk. And nearly 20 years ago, social worker Elizabeth Heck asked us to understand the impacts of caregiving and create policies and programs to meet the needs of the caregivers. How have we done? What has research shown us? Do we advocate better for caregivers today, or do we consider them, at the end of the day, barriers to care? What we need is a unique individual who can create a crosswalk between the caregiver and the older adult, and I can think of no one better to do so than gerontologist Dr. Julie Masters, and we are fortunate to have Dr. Masters with us now to share her expertise and her history. Dr. Masters holds the Terry Haney Chair of Gerontology. She is professor and chair of the Department of Gerontology at the University of Nebraska, Omaha. Dr. Masters, welcome to AMDA On The Go.
Oh, thank you for this opportunity. I'm grateful.
Is it okay if I call you Julie?
Please, I would prefer that. Thank you.
Great. So, Julie, I typically like to start the conversation with somewhat of a historical perspective to set our framework for discussion. You know, there's always been confusion around the terms geriatrics and gerontology. I am often introduced myself as a gerontologist. Your department's mission statement is about knowledge and education and the inspiration of future leaders to positively influence the aging process and to advocate for older adults, their caregivers, and the communities in which they live. And one of your department's core purposes is to enhance the ability of those working with older adults to understand, serve, and advocate for the aging population. So, a number of questions to start us off. Remind us of the distinction between the two fields, geriatrics and gerontology. How has the field of gerontology evolved over the past 10 to 20 years? And what role has gerontology played in the advocacy of caregivers and communities around the care of the older adult?
Well, I think, first of all, asking the question of what is the difference, just as you are sometimes referred to as a gerontologist, we will have people who will ask our department, are you in geriatrics? Is this what you do? And so we have to continually educate the community about the difference. So geriatrics would be viewed just as the kind of work that you do, more from a clinical standpoint. So thinking about the person's health from the perspective of medicine, whereas gerontology is a way to complement geriatrics, but it's different because what we are as gerontologists are social scientists. So we look at the physical, the psychological, and the social aspects of aging. We're also interested in environmental aspects, so thinking about the built environment. So as gerontologists, we're interested in people who, if you think about aging starting at the age of 60, we're looking at and interested in a 60-year time span. So if maximum lifespan is 120 for human beings, we're talking about a 60-year period in which we're interested in how people are aging in terms from a physical standpoint. So thinking about health and wellness to a psychological standpoint, how can they be, or how can, I'm going to add we, how can we be challenged appropriately so that we can maintain our cognitive health? And then socially, who's in my life? Who's supporting me? This particular podcast is about caregiving, but it's also about what can I as an aging person do to make a difference in the world? And then that environmental piece, am I living in an environment, am I living in space that will support me and help sustain me over a 20, 30, 40, 50-year time period? So gerontology looks at aging from a much broader standpoint. However, I think we are very close in connection with our colleagues in geriatrics because we work naturally together. In fact, here in Nebraska, we have a very strong relationship with geriatrics and gerontology and palliative care at the University of Nebraska Medical Center. So some of our students who might be preparing themselves at the undergraduate level with a bachelor's degree in gerontology, so they have a rich, in-depth understanding of aging, will go on to be physicians or nurse practitioners or things of that sort. So gerontology is the social science side. And then you do such a good job at asking additional questions and thinking about how has the evolution of the field of gerontology changed. I've been in gerontology since the 1980s, which seems like 100 years ago for some. And at that time, our understanding about aging was limited, and it tended to focus more on an older white female between the ages of 75 and 80 who was widowed, who may have been living in a nursing home. That was then. Our research was limited. Our understanding about aging was limited. Today, when we think about gerontology and our ability from a research standpoint to think about aging in a different way, we are seeing a much broader view or a much broader brush about really the heterogeneity of aging, that aging is about diversity. Aging is about the different life experiences of people, not only who may have been born in the United States, but people who are immigrating to this country, and how their views on aging are also changing the way we think about things. I think the other thing, Wayne, that is somewhat interesting to me as a researcher is this emergence of older men that are living to be 85 and beyond. And that's one of those things for the first time in history, we're now thinking about aging that includes both men and women. It includes people from different backgrounds, different life experiences, and so forth. So it's really an exciting time to be in the field. And then I think your question about, what has gerontology done in terms of advocating for caregivers in the community? We have a responsibility as gerontologists to advocate not only for the people providing care, but the people receiving care. So, we've got a pretty full plate in terms of advocacy. But I think what's interesting is when we look at the numbers and we think about the numbers of people that are available to be caregivers today compared to, for instance, in 2010, where there might have been 7 caregivers for every person 80 and older, we're thinking about going forward in the future, we may only have 2 or 3 people, and that's probably being generous, but 2 or 3 people who could be caregivers in the future. And so we're now thinking about how can we prepare other people maybe outside of the family to be a source of support.
What a wonderful, wonderful description of gerontology that is so impactful. Thank you for that. In the November-December issue of Caring for the Ages, you wrote an amazing article entitled The Grace and Dignity of Caregiving. You talk about moving away from the terms typically associated with caregiving, which I would consider to be negative, those of burden and stress. And you focus on positive concepts, competency, role satisfaction, well-being, and fulfillment, a story you write that is not always told about caregiving. You wrote that you yourself were not aware enough at the onset of your own caregiving experience to recognize how rewarding it could be. Tell us about your experience. Tell us about this article that you wrote, if you would, and why you called your experience in caregiving a gift.
Okay. So I think just briefly, I had the opportunity to be a caregiver to my dad who had been diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease in 2008 and had a pretty accelerated journey with him in terms of caregiving, where he had had rheumatoid arthritis for a number of years and a whole slew of problems literally from head to toe. And in New Year's Eve 2008, because of weakened bone structure, his hip gave out, and he ended up breaking a hip and having to be hospitalized. And in a very short period of time, from that date to Father's Day of June 21st of 2009, he had been hospitalized 6 times and he had moved 5 times. Mm. And I offer that because even though I'm a gerontologist, even though I had been studying caregiving and aging issues for a number of decades, being in the throes of it gave me such a different appreciation of what all these people I'd been studying, and actually had been studying at the time because I was working on an Alzheimer's demonstration grant, to see that caregiving, while it can be very challenging and can be very stressful, that there are also gifts that can emerge from that. And what I mean by those gifts is seeing that there are people that come into your life that you would not have ever met had it not been for the caregiving experience. I use the example of caregiving in a way it's like jury duty, that while people may have this sense of this is not something I want to do, but when they get into the middle of it, they see the richness of the other people, think about the jury business, they think about the other people that they're spending time with in that capacity. Well, extend that over to caregiving, that you meet people who are willing to walk the journey with you that, again, you would not have met previously. Mm-hmm. So I think that was part of the gift. But I think the other part of this, Wayne, was being able to see in my brother, who, you know, typically when we think about caregivers, we tend to think that they're middle-aged women who are caring not only for parents or in-laws but children, and that's our typical caregiver. But I think my brother showed to me and to others that he was very well equipped to serve as a caregiver as well. In fact, he not only was supporting my dad, he was supporting his wife's parents. Both of her parents were also having, you think about comorbidity or multimorbidity, experiencing a number of health issues. And his willingness to roll up his sleeves and to step in and make a difference was striking. Mm-hmm. And so I saw that as a gift. But I think the other thing was just the relationship that developed with my dad that had not been in place previously. You know, I think sometimes as professionals, we go off in the world and we may not pay attention to the things that really matter most. And I think the caregiving experience really put things into focus. It gave all of us an appreciation of what we had been offered at this time, and that was to make sure that not only did he receive physical care, but that he also received the dignity that he deserved. He was in a skilled facility, which, you hear a variety of stories about the kind of care that's provided. And it was finding a place where we knew that not only would they care for his physical needs, but they would truly love him. Mm. And I think that was also the gift. It was recognizing the kinds of things that are provided to people in skilled facilities that can really make a difference in their life and in their well-being.
Wanting a place where he would feel loved.
Wonderful. Yes.
Wonderful.
Yes. By the way, isn't that what we would all want? Hmm. So if we would want to be loved and cared for, shouldn't we also have that expectation for our family members? Shouldn't, and friends, or in, you know, patients, the people that we interact with? I think we could do a little better job in this country of making sure that older people who are so vulnerable and frail receive the care that they so richly deserve.
The success of your practice depends on a support team that knows exactly how to navigate through the many variables and nuances of post-acute medicine. Based on years of practical clinical experience, the team at U.S. Post Acute Care is dedicated to enabling you to deliver the very best quality of patient care, providing a unique complement of administrative and clinical educational support services. To learn more about what U.S. Post Acute Care can do for your practice, visit uspostacutecare.com.
We're talking with gerontologist Dr. Julie Masters about caregiving. Julie, in a 2015 Journal of the American Medical Director Association, JAMDA, article entitled Caregiving Well-Being, Is It on Your Radar? The authors acknowledge that there's a lack of clarity on the provider's perceived responsibility to involve the caregiver in the medical intervention process or assess their caregiving-related needs and own personal needs. We're all aware of the limitations of HIPAA and we're all aware of the protection that's required, mandated, regarding personal health information. So looking at it from the other side, how can providers, either in primary care, the post-acute setting, as you've alluded to, or the hospital, appreciate or involve the caregiver who has literally been in the trenches as much or much more than any other provider, to feel relevant and important, especially in the midst of issues around cognitive decline or functional compromise? You know, the spirit of AMDA is that it strives to provide tools. You know, what are some actionable steps that we could take tomorrow in respect and acknowledgement of the caregiver, perhaps even drawing upon your own experience as you've discussed?
Well, I wonder if maybe this needs to be looked at from a different perspective. And what I mean is, I think it's a challenge for the provider to be able to engage in conversation with caregivers when there's a time limit, meaning there's only so much time in the day to see so many patients, to work with them, and to make sure that the things that need to be taken care of are addressed. Okay, so there's that side. Where I'm going with that is, I wonder as a society, particularly as a country that's experiencing growth in its aging population, if some of these conversations, Wayne, don't need to happen way before somebody goes to the doctor's office. Meaning, what can we do to normalize discussions about the kinds of care that people would want. Okay. And so where I'm going with that is that people talk about when they're in good health and can make some important decisions to have some of those conversations in advance. Because I think the challenge for the caregiver is trying to second guess or trying to be the brains of the person, their loved one, whether it's a parent or a spouse or someone else, trying to figure out what they would want in terms of care. And so if there's not been any sort of discussion, if there's not been any sort of opportunity to be able to say what a person would really want, that can be challenging for the caregiver. Mm-hmm. And I think that when you think about from a caregiving standpoint, it's not just about taking care of ADLs and IADLs, but it's also thinking about the future and what's going to be our next step. What do we need to do if? And then you can fill in the blank. So I think where I'm going with this is more discussion in advance would help the caregiver be able to make decisions down the road. But if we're not willing to talk about aging, if we're not willing to talk about some of the challenges associated with aging, then it can make it difficult for folks to know what they need to do when the opportunity presents itself. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense as far as what I'm suggesting?
So what you're essentially saying is what, you know, we talk about a lot, but we really fail to act upon, and that's advanced care planning. What are the goals and wishes of an individual discussed at any state of health, but preferably the earlier the better, and continued to be discussed in a serial fashion a long time? So as you've said, when there's a crisis or a change in condition, the caregiver has information that perhaps nobody else has, but of course everybody should have it. So mm-hmm. I guess I would turn back to you, and from the gerontology point of view, in the community, in the home, the religious setting, what can we do to help folks actually have these advanced care planning discussions?
Well, and I would take it one step further. So advanced care planning, thinking about, do I have a medical directive? Do I have a living will, durable power of attorney for health care, and so on? I would extend that to end-of-life planning, or maybe to talk about aging planning, although I don't think that sounds very good from a marketing standpoint. But thinking more broadly in terms of if I need care, who's going to provide that care? Or if I want to, for instance, talking about things like hospice and palliative care, when we talk about it when we're well and we can see the benefits of it, when those discussions need to happen, it's not so frightening. Where we are now is we look at life more from a linear standpoint, and we wait until there's a crisis to talk about things that tend to elicit a lot of stress and crisis type feelings. But when we've thought about it in a full perspective and to think about how do I want my last days to be, or my last weeks or my last months, when we can look at it from a broader perspective, then the kinds of decisions that are made will reflect more about what our last breath is going to be like, as opposed to all the breaths in between.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's something that we continue to work on as a profession, the profession of geriatrics, but mm-hmm. it would be great if we could further align with our brothers and sisters in gerontology and come up with some practical tools that would enable this not to be a stigmatized discussion or an awkward or something that people just don't want to talk about now, as my grandparents would say, into something more purposeful and impactful.
Wayne, let me just say, and I agree with you 100%, and as gerontologists, we have an obligation to be supportive to you and all the other geriatricians and palliative care folks out there to make sure that we begin to normalize the conversation, to think about aging from a different vantage point. In my own life, my dad did a beautiful job in having everything put together from a legal standpoint and from a financial standpoint, meaning he had all the documents in order. We could, he had a business, so to be able to sign checks so that the people working for him were paid and could engage in some of the day-to-day business work for him. And so credit to him for being so forward-thinking, because when you're in the throes of trying to care for somebody, you don't have time to think about some of the minute details that might be tied to some of that end-of-life planning or thinking about that in greater detail. You just not only don't have the time, you may not have the emotional energy to think about things. But when we have something in place in advance, it can make a difference. I think the other thing that might be worth mentioning, and you said as far as from a religious perspective, in the case of my dad, he was a devout Roman Catholic and was very much connected to his church and to his pastor, and his pastor would visit him frequently. And it was his pastor who, as a family, we could turn to at the end of his life to make decisions about, for instance, signing a do not resuscitate order. Things that, you know, I think without having that kind of support system in place would have been much more difficult. But recognizing that there was someone who could speak authoritatively from a religious standpoint to say what you're doing is okay, I think there's value to that. And when, and again, it goes back to when I said, you know, this, why caregiving is a gift. You're on this journey, you meet people or you interact with people you never thought you would interact with. If it wasn't for the change in my dad's health and being able to talk to his pastor, I think we might have been in a very different place.
Julie, as has become customary in the time that we have remaining, I typically try to be somewhat provocative with my guests, but not too much so, and definitely not today. But, you know, when I give presentations, any presentation, no matter the subject, I always place a slide with a picture I cut out of a magazine many, many years ago. It's an ad for life insurance. And it shows an elderly couple sitting on a bench with their backs to the camera. Over him, it reads, he has Alzheimer's. And over her, it reads, she suffers from it. You know, I worry, especially after our last question, you know, I worry about our community and our ability to care for older adults moving forward, our ability to understand their goals and their wishes. You know, we have folks impacted by social determinants of health, behavioral health issues, and the lack of accessible primary care providers and geriatricians. And you mentioned earlier the concept of heterogeneity, and that is the essence of geriatrics. You know, as a gerontologist, if you're able to take a step back, do you see an impending crisis? What are we missing in addressing the needs of this unique segment of the adult population, each one typically having or associated with a respective caregiver?
Well, I think the way you frame this has, couldn't be better said or asked in terms of about the future. Do I see an impending crisis? I absolutely do. I've been trying to purge the word crisis and replace it with opportunity. Because when you put it as an opportunity, it says, all right, what can we do to address this impending, and not even explosion, but growth in the aging of the population? What we are seeing are people that are going into their older years who may not have anyone to care for them, because maybe because of divorce or because they didn't have kids, or maybe they had kids but their kids don't have the emotional or cognitive support to be able to care for their parents. I think we're going to be in an interesting situation, not only today, but going forward in terms of who's going to provide that care. We're seeing countries such as Japan, where they're having to rely on technology to replace a caregiver that never existed. Places like China, where by 2035, Wayne, there will be more people 60 and older in China than the entire U.S. population. They're in a caregiving situation where they don't have the caregivers, I guess is the point. They don't have the caregivers to provide the support. And so we're going to have to get very creative in terms of making certain that people have the other people in their lives to provide that support. It could be that home care, particularly non-skilled medical home care, will grow by leaps and bounds because we'll need to be able to hire people to provide that support. It could be that we may need to tap into other people, and maybe it's younger, older people who could serve as caregivers for much older people. So I think we're going to have to think very creatively in terms of who's going to be able to provide that support.
We have been privileged to speak with and learn from gerontologist Dr. Julie Masters from the University of Nebraska, Omaha. Dr. Masters, I can't thank you enough for spending your time with AMDA on the go.
I'm very grateful for the opportunity, Wayne, and I'm also grateful to you and all the other geriatricians out there who are making a difference in the lives of older people as well as their families. So thank you.
References for this podcast can be found at paltc.org/podcast. Until next time, I'm Dr. Wayne Saltzman for this innovation podcast that we call AMDA On The Go.
Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post-Acute Care. If you are a physician and interested in obtaining ABPLM pre-approved certified medical director credits for certification or recertification, go to our new learning management system at apex.paltc.org. Click on podcast and follow the link to this latest episode. Thank you.